This COE is based on the New York State appellate decisions released in March 2020 dealing with negligence issues. Initially, selected decisions were summarized, and the summaries were put up on the New York Appellate Digest website in March of 2020. And subsequently, those summaries have been organized into the March 2020 Negligence Update Pamphlet. It's that pamphlet which forms the written materials for this CLE course, and the page references are to that pamphlet. First case is Castillo on page 4, medical malpractice case, Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held conflicting expert opinions in this medical malpractice action created a question of fact. The court wrote, summary judgment is not appropriate in a medical malpractice action where, as here, the parties adduce conflicting medical expert opinions. Such credibility issues can only be resolved by a jury. Next is Rossi on pages 4 and 5, products liability case. It's an interesting case because the product which caused the injuries was lost. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant manufacturer, his name is Doka, of an allegedly defective ratchet was not entitled to dismissal of the complaint on the ground that plaintiff could not produce the ratchet, spoliation ground. The ratchet was used to move heavy concrete forms into place along a track. Allegedly, the ratchets broke when extra pressure was placed on them when the forms became bound on the track. Plaintiff alleged he was injured when he used his foot to increase the pressure on the ratchet when the form became bound. Because this was a design defect case, and because the ratchets allegedly had broken before under similar circumstance, the defendant manufacturer could present a defense, and therefore the loss of the ratchet did not warrant dismissal of the complaint. Court wrote, in cases like this, where the claim is based on a design defect as opposed to a manufacturing defect, the absence of the product is not necessarily fatal to the defendant. As this court has observed, a product's design possibly might be evaluated and the defect proved circumstantially. Circumstantial evidence could, one would imagine, be the testimony of someone involved in the design process and plans or photographs of the product before it entered the stream of commerce. It could also, assuming that the missing product was one of multiple units manufactured using the same design, be another one of those units. Doka does not, in any meaningful way, argue why its inability to inspect the exact ratchet that plaintiff was using would prevent it from defending against the product's liability claim. Next is Darrow on pages 5 and 6. It's another product's liability case. Third Department held plaintiff's expert did not raise a question of fact in this product's liability case. Plaintiff's decedent was killed by a crane operated remotely by plaintiff's decedent. Defendant's experts attributed the accident to plaintiff's decedent's acts of leaning into the path of the crane and bending over with the remote attached to his hip, causing the crane to be activated inadvertently. Both leaning into the path of the crane and bending over with the remote attached were known to be dangerous, and plaintiff's decedent had trained others accordingly. Although plaintiff's expert averred that a dead man's switch would have prevented the accident, he did not present any supporting evidence. The court wrote, an expert's affidavit offered as the only evidence to defeat summary judgment must contain sufficient allegations to demonstrate that the conclusions it contains are more than mere speculation. and would, if offered alone at trial, support a verdict in the proponent's favor. Initially, although the expert alleged that he inspected the remote, his affidavit was not supported by facts of his own independent testing of the device. Rather, he relied on deposition testimony of other witnesses to explain the functions of the remote. Furthermore, although the expert averred that the remote could be made safer by adding a dead man's switch or by implementing joysticks, he offered no proposed designs that could feasibly be installed, and moreover, he pointed to no industry standards or data to support his conclusion that the absence of a dead man's switch rendered the remote unsafe. After all, a factual issue regarding design defect is not established merely by pointing to efforts within the industry to make a safer product. Without providing some detail as to how the current product is not reasonably safe and how a feasible alternative would be safer, given the expert's failure to elaborate and mindful of the testimony of multiple witnesses for the defendants who averred that they were not aware of any remote controls in the industry that use a dead man's switch for crane operations, plaintiff's proof was insufficient to raise a triable issue regarding design defect. Next is the Pink Jaffrey case on page 6, slip and fall case, involves landlord-tenant issues. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. Defendant property owner did not demonstrate it was an out-of-possession landlord, and defendants failed to eliminate questions of fact with respect to several elements of a slip and fall action. The court wrote, the defendants failed to eliminate triable issues of fact as to whether they had a duty to maintain in a reasonably safe condition the area of the parking lot where the plaintiff allegedly slipped. They further failed to eliminate triable issues of fact as to whether they or anyone on their behalf caused, created, or exacerbated the ice condition upon which the plaintiff allegedly slipped and fell, and whether they lacked constructive notice of the alleged ice condition. Next is DeCarbo on page 7, another slip and fall. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's slip and fall action should have been dismissed. The cause of the fall was alleged to be a worn marble step, which is not actionable. The court wrote, defendants established their entitlement to judgment as a matter of law in this action, where plaintiff was injured when, while descending interior stairs in defendant's building, she slipped and fell on a marble step that had a worn tread. A worn marble tread without more is not an actionable defect. In opposition, plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact. Having abandoned her claim that defendants were negligent in keeping the stairs free of moisture, plaintiff cannot now argue that the existence of moisture on the stairs would be an actionable condition. Nor did plaintiff's experts establish that in addition to the worn marble stair treads, they lacked adequate slip resistance, as the coefficient of friction value that the experts used as a standard value was not shown to be an accepted industry standard. Nor did the experts' affidavits raise a triable issue of fact, since the opinions concerning the cause of plaintiff's slip were speculative. Next is Porosnik on pages 7 and 8, another slip and fall, this time involving tree wells in city sidewalks. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant was not liable for plaintiff's slip and fall because abutting property owners are not responsible for the condition of tree wells in a sidewalk. The court wrote, Administrative Code of the City of New York, Section 7-210, places the duty to maintain a sidewalk in a reasonably safe condition on the owner of the property abutting the sidewalk and provides for civil liability for injuries proximately caused by the failure to so maintain the sidewalk. However, the statute does not extend that duty of maintenance to city-owned tree wells or provide for civil liability for injuries occurring in city-owned tree wells. Thus, liability may be imposed on the abutting landowner for injuries caused by a dangerous condition in a tree well only where the landowner has affirmatively created the dangerous condition, negligently made repairs to the area, or caused the dangerous condition to occur through a special use of that area. Here, defendant established its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that it had no duty to maintain the city-owned tree well, did not create the allegedly dangerous condition, did not negligently repair the sidewalk abutting the tree well, and did not cause the condition to occur through any special use of the tree well. Next is Griffin on page 8, another slip and fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether defendant had constructive notice of the condition which allegedly caused plaintiff's slip and fall. The court wrote, a defendant has constructive notice of a hazardous condition on property when the condition is visible and apparent and has existed for a sufficient length to afford the defendant a reasonable opportunity to discover and remedy it. To meet its burden on the issue of a lack of constructive notice, a defendant is required to offer evidence as to when the accident site was last cleaned or inspected before the accident. Mere reference to general cleaning practices with no evidence regarding any specific cleaning or inspection of the area in question is insufficient to establish a lack of constructive notice. Here, the defendant failed to establish prima facie that it did not have constructive notice of the alleged hazardous condition. While the affidavit of the building superintendent referenced general inspection and cleaning practices, the defendant failed to submit evidence regarding specific cleaning or inspection of the area in question relative to the time when the plaintiff's accident occurred. Next is Ruland on page 9, another slip and fall. First Department, reversing or modifying Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether the ice on which plaintiff slipped and fell pre-existed the recent snowfall. Plaintiff slipped and fell at around 7:30 a.m., and pursuant to the New York City Administrative Code, defendant had until 11 a.m. to clear the recent snow under the storm in progress rule. The court wrote, because it snowed overnight, defendant had until 11 a.m. to clear any fresh snow and ice. However, an issue of fact exists regarding whether the ice on which plaintiff slipped was pre-existing. Plaintiff testified and submitted witness affidavits to the effect that the ice was dirty and trod upon and had been present for days. Moreover, while defendant submitted certified climatological records from Central Park in reply and in opposition to plaintiff's cross motion, defendant cannot remedy a fundamental deficiency in its moving papers with evidence submitted in reply, although they may be considered in opposition to plaintiff's cross motion. In any event, the records show that the temperatures remained below or only slightly above freezing during much of the 6 days after the defendant asserts that the last snowfall occurred, and defendant offers only speculation that such temperatures would have melted previous accumulation of snow and ice. Next is the Daniels case on pages 9 and 10, another slip and fall, this time from the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, ordering a new trial, in a brief memorandum with no description of the facts, held the evidence of prior accidents involving the gap between the subway train and the platform should not have been admitted because there was no showing the conditions were the same. However, the evidence of the non-mandatory gap standards were properly admitted. The court wrote, in these circumstances, the trial court properly admitted plaintiff's expert testimony regarding the non-mandatory gap standards promulgated by the American Public Transit Association and the Public Transportation Safety Board. However, Supreme Court abused its discretion as a matter of law by admitting evidence of prior accidents at New York City subway stations involving the gap between the train car and platform in the absence of a showing that the relative conditions of those accidents were substantially the same as plaintiff's accident. Next is Matos on pages 10 and 11, another slip and fall. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant landlord's motion for summary judgment in this wet bathroom floor slip and fall case should not have been granted. Plaintiff alleged the landlord failed to repair brackets for the shower curtain. The fact that the water on the floor was in open and obvious condition relieved landlord of the duty to warn, but not the duty to keep the property safe. The court wrote, Supreme Court erred in granting summary judgment to defendants on the basis that plaintiff failed to identify the condition of water on the floor before he slipped and fell. Supreme Court incorrectly found that any conclusion that plaintiff slipped and fell because of water accumulation would be based on speculation. Plaintiff argues correctly that even if in his deposition testimony he did not explicitly state that he noticed water on the floor before he stepped out of the shower, a jury could reasonably infer that he slipped and fell on water on the floor due to the absence of a shower curtain. Defendant's proof failed to negate this reasonable inference. Even if a hazard qualifies as open and obvious as a matter of law, that characteristic merely eliminates the property owner's duty to warn of the hazard, but does not eliminate the broader duty to maintain the premises in a reasonably safe condition. Defendants argue that the broken brackets were not an inherently dangerous condition, but rather a benign condition. However, as plaintiff correctly observes, the purpose of the shower brackets was to hold up the shower curtain, and the purpose of a shower curtain is to prevent the accumulation of water when the shower is in use. Next is Brennan on page 11, another slip and fall. The Second Department determined the verdict in this slip and fall case was not contrary to the weight of the evidence. Plaintiff descended a stairway which had leaves on it. The court wrote, the plaintiff's testimony sufficiently identified the condition that caused her to fall. The evidence at trial failed to establish as a matter of law that the condition at issue was both open and obvious and not inherently dangerous. A jury's finding that a party was at fault, but that such fault was not a proximate cause of the accident, is inconsistent and against the weight of the evidence only when the issues are so inextricably interwoven as to make it logically impossible to find negligence without also finding proximate cause. Here, the jury could have reasonably concluded that the plaintiff was negligent in choosing to descend the stairway despite the presence of leaves, but that her negligence merely furnished the occasion for the accident. Accordingly, the jury's determination that the plaintiff's conduct was not a substantial factor in causing the accident was not contrary to the weight of the evidence. Next is Rivera on page 12, another slip and fall. First Department held that a quarter to half-inch depression where a water cap was located in a sidewalk was a trivial defect and therefore could not be the basis of a slip and fall action. The court wrote, the alleged defect on which plaintiff tripped was trivial and non-actionable as a matter of law based on the characteristics and surrounding circumstances. The water cap was a quarter to half an inch below the surface of the sidewalk, and the photographic evidence shows no defects in the water cap and surrounding sidewalk. Furthermore, plaintiff never attributed the cause of the accident to any broken or cracked cement or inadequate lighting. Next is Sanchez on page 12. It's a spoliation case involving a municipality. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the city defendants should have been sanctioned for spoliation of evidence. The action stemmed from a traffic accident involving a police vehicle, and the city defendants were put on notice that they would assert an emergency defense by the notice of claim. But the pre-accident police communications were not preserved. The court wrote, defendants had an obligation to preserve the pre-accident audio recordings at the time they were destroyed because the police department internal report and plaintiff's notice of claim, which attached the public police accident report, put defendants on notice that they would likely assert an emergency operation defense. Therefore, pre-accident audio communication between the dispatcher and the New York Police Department vehicle or officers involved in the accident should have been preserved in case it was needed for future litigation. Under the circumstances presented, the imposition of an adverse inference charge would be an appropriate sanction. Next is McDowell on page 13. It's a toxic torts lead paint case. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this lead paint exposure case should have been granted. Defendant was a co-owner of the subject property, but he was able to demonstrate his connection to the property was such that he did not have actual or constructive notice of the hazardous lead paint condition. The court wrote, defendant owned the subject property as a tenant in common with his father during the period of plaintiff's tenancy from 1992 to 1994. In support of his motions, defendant submitted his affidavit, wherein he averred, among other things, that he was a co-owner of the property on paper only, that his father handled all day-to-day maintenance of the property, and that defendant never entered plaintiff's apartments or hired anyone to make repairs thereto during plaintiff's tenancy. Defendant further averred that he did not have a key to the apartments and that he never spoke to or received complaints from plaintiffs or plaintiff's mother. Defendant's submissions also established that he had no knowledge of inspections for or the existence of lead paint at the property during the plaintiff's tenancy, and that he was unaware that the property was constructed at a time before lead paint was banned, that paint was peeling at the property, that lead paint posed a danger to young children, and that young children lived on the property. Regardless of whether defendant's father had actual or constructive notice through his own involvement with the property, that notice cannot be imputed to defendant absent evidence of defendant's own actual and constructive notice. Next is Martinez on page 14, a traffic accident case. First Department, in a decision which does not discuss the relevant facts, held the $10.5 million verdict for conscious pain and suffering was excessive and ordered a new trial unless plaintiff stipulates to a $3 million verdict. Plaintiff's decedent was crossing the street when she was struck by defendant's van. The court wrote, the jury's finding that defendant was solely at fault for the decedent's death is supported by legally sufficient evidence and is not against the weight of the evidence. Plaintiff's evidence established that the decedent was crossing the street with the right-of-way when she was struck by a van operated by defendant's employee making a left turn. Defendant presented no evidence to rebut plaintiff's evidence. Its argument that the decedent may have been crossing the street outside of the crosswalk is speculative, given that its employee did not see the decedent until after the accident. The position of the decedent's body after impact is not probative as to whether she was walking in the crosswalk prior to being struck. In light of this determination, we do not reach defendant's arguments about the propriety of testimony elicited and statements made by plaintiff's counsel about its hiring practices generally and its hiring of the driver involved in the accident specifically. We find the award for the decedent's conscious pain and suffering excessive to the extent indicated. Next is Bardasbanian on pages 14 and 15, another traffic accident case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the summary judgment motion by the driver of the middle vehicle in this chain reaction accident should have been granted. The rearmost driver pushed the stopped middle vehicle into the plaintiff's vehicle. The court wrote, a rear-end collision with a stopped or stopping vehicle establishes a prima facie case of negligence on the part of the operator of the rear vehicle, requiring that operator to come forth with evidence of a non-negligent explanation for the collision to rebut the inference of negligence. Evidence that a vehicle was struck in the rear and propelled into the vehicle in front of it may provide a sufficient non-negligent explanation. Thus, in a chain collision accident, the operator of the middle vehicle may establish prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that the middle vehicle was properly stopped behind the lead vehicle when it was struck from behind by the rear vehicle and propelled into the lead vehicle. Next is Pittman. On page 15, another traffic accident case. The Second Department held the school district's motion for summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case was properly denied. Plaintiff alleged the school bus driver gestured to plaintiff to make a turn, and plaintiff's car was then struck by another car driven by defendant Mallon going through the intersection. The court wrote, "When one driver chooses to gratuitously signal to another person, indicating that it is safe to proceed, or that the signaling driver will yield the right of way, the signaling driver assumes a duty to do so reasonably under the circumstances. Here, the school district failed to establish that the plaintiff did not rely on the bus driver's gesture that it was safe for the plaintiff to make his turn. The school district also failed to establish that the defendant driver's alleged negligent conduct in operating Mallon's vehicle constituted an intervening and superseding act which broke the causal nexus between the bus driver's alleged negligence and the plaintiff's injury." At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this March 2020 negligence update CLE. The verification code is BUS. Again, the verification code for this March 2020 negligence CLE, update CLE, is BUS. Next is Hodnett on page 16. Another traffic accident case, this time involving negligence per se, based on a violation of vehicle and traffic law. The Second Department, setting aside the defense verdict in this traffic accident case, held the bus driver was negligent as a matter of law. To avoid a stopped vehicle, the driver, Barreto, crossed a double yellow line and lost control of the bus, which crashed into a store. The plaintiffs were bus passengers. The court wrote, "This court has held that a driver who crosses over a double yellow line into opposing traffic, unless justified by an emergency not of the driver's own making, violated the vehicle and traffic law and is guilty of negligence as a matter of law." And it cites Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1126A. Here, although the evidence demonstrated that there was snow or slush on the surface of the subject road, the adverse weather conditions, as well as the fact that the road sloped downhill, were foreseeable and known to Barreto and did not provide a non-negligent explanation for Barreto's violation of the vehicle and traffic law. Although the evidence demonstrated that there was a vehicle stopped in the bus's lane of travel, thereby obstructing its path, the evidence also demonstrated that the stopped vehicle was observable from a far distance, that the bus did not slow down after the stopped vehicle came into Barreto's view, and that Barreto crossed over the double yellow line without slowing down. Under the circumstances, Barreto's loss of control over the bus was the result of his own negligent driving in adverse weather conditions, rather than the result of an emergency not of his own making. The absence of an emergency was recognized by the Supreme Court in its refusal to grant the defendant's request that the jury be given an instruction on the emergency doctrine. Barreto's operation of the bus under the circumstances here violated Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1120A. Such violation constitutes negligence as a matter of law and could not properly be disregarded by the jury. The final case is on page 17, McIntosh, workers' compensation case. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant employer's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Plaintiff was injured while acting within the scope of his employment. Workers' compensation, therefore, was his exclusive remedy unless he was gravely injured or there was an agreement with the employer. The court wrote, "Workers' Compensation Law Section 11 prohibits third-party claims for contribution or indemnification against an employer unless the employee has sustained a grave injury or there is a written contract entered into prior to the accident or occurrence by which the employer had expressly agreed to contribution to or indemnification of the third-party claimant." Here, in support of its motion, the employer, ABC Tank, established that there was no written agreement between the parties that required it to contribute, indemnify, or procure insurance. Further, ABC Tank established that the plaintiff was injured in the course of his employment and that plaintiff's injuries did not constitute a grave injury within the meaning of Workers' Compensation Law, Section 11. That concludes this March 2020 negligence update CLE.